Accession number 8736, rule number 16.
Lord Harding, tape 16. The battle for Tobruk, was that as straightforward as the others had been? You know, the Italians mainly being defensive.
It followed the same sort of pattern as Badia. It meant a very extensive patrolling by the Australians to maintain, to get complete domination of the area of leading up to the defences, also full details of the defensive, the anti-tank ditch and wire and so on. And then it took the same form as a break-in by infantry followed by the tanks. And then a clearing up of the whole of the defensive area by an infantry assault. That a book. I have a copy of it, but I don't know where it is. Written by an Australian officer, which describes in detail. I think he was either a company officer, probably a platoon commander, in one of the Australian infantry battalions, and it does describe very clearly the operations of the Australians, both in Badia and I think Tobruk, and it's called Not to the Duty Only. I had a copy, and I think my grandson's got it now. But it does describe in detail the problems and the difficulties which the Australian infantry had, first of all in breaking in to the defence, and then in clearing the whole of the fortress area. I call it a fortress because that's really what it was. They were very good, excellent, and as I said earlier, the great bulk of the Italian forces didn't put up any very stiff resistance, but some did. There were pockets of very very stiff resistance, and some of the artillery fought well. So they had a tough time. The casualties were not all that heavy, but they did have a lot of casualties. And then Tobruk having fallen, then the question arose of what next. We followed up the Italian retreat, was followed up, and with the Australians on the right and the 7th Armoured Division on the left and in the desert. There's what's called the Jebel, which was the bulge of the desert, which is cultivated and wooded and inhabited, like places like Baci, and leading up to Benghazi. And the question was, what was the next plan to be done? There was an operation against the Italian force, which was south of the Jebel, guarding the approach across the desert, which was carried out, and to the best of my recollection, it was rather abortive, and Dick O'Connor was rather disappointed about that. However, he eventually decided that we would launch the 7th Armoured Division straight across the axis of the bulge, and is right across the desert, aimed at the place called Antlet, cutting off the hell of the Jebel and cutting on and reaching the coast south of Benghazi. Well, it was a very brave decision to launch that operation, because nobody really knew what the going conditions were like across that arc of the desert. And, of course, we hadn't got all that amount of supplies of ammunition or water or petrol. And so it was a one only effort. I mean, if it had bunged down, if it had halted, if it had been checked, it might have been a failure. But in effect, it was entirely successful, and the Italians, who by that time were retreating through the Jebel and down through Benghazi, were cut off completely. And there was a very successful operation on the coast, on the coastal road, south of Benghazi, at Biedefom. And I think the chap who was deserved most of the credit like that was a chap called John Coombe, who was then had been commanding the Air Hussars and was then with the support group. And he and some armor, the 11th Hussars with their armored cars and some armor and some artillery, were able to get straight across the desert and cut off the German retreat, Italian retreat, south of Benghazi. And that was routed. Finished the route, the complete route of the Italian forces in Libya. It was a very brave decision on the part of O'Connor's part. It was brilliantly carried out by the 11th Hussars, and I can't remember which tank regiment it was, but by the tank regiment involved and by the support group of the 7th Armored Division. And they were able to set up a block south of Benghazi and completely finish off the Italian forces in Libya.
Because you had travelled some miles, your supply lines must have been extremely
stretched. Well, this was where the risk was taken, because it's a very difficult. I went across following on. Actually, at one time we had an extraordinary, remarkable man called Bingo Brown, who was a liaison officer. And the 7th Armored Division, when they were halfway across the desert, were halted and uncertain. At least I think Dickie Crary, who was commanding them, was not very happy about his supply arrangements. And Bingo Brown flew me, and I landed in the desert at where 7th Armored Division headquarters were halted, and we discussed the whole situation, Dickie Cray and I, and with Bingo Brown and his staff, and decided that come what may, it must go on. And they went on, and they did. And they cut off the Italian retreat. So all told, there were a great many risks taken. The operation was carried out, I think, splendidly, and it is a very difficult piece of desert. And they cut off the Italians, and that was the end of the campaign.
Were you thinking then that the Germans might be coming in soon?
No, we had no, as far as I recollect, we had no indication at that stage of German intervention. I don't know, they may have had some indication in London or even in Cairo, but as far as I was concerned, we had no indication that the Germans would intervene.
How well prepared were you for that terrain? Now, did you have good maps? Were you aware of what you were going into when you started pushing?
No, they weren't bad. They weren't all that good. I mean, they were going maps. We knew it was bad going across that part through Mazous, across to Antelat.
Was it going into the unknown?
Escarpment the other side. We had a lot of difficulty with communications because in that part you get electric storms, and we had We had what they call it number 9 sets, wireless. And it was very difficult at times to get through from one headquarters to another. I remember spending quite about the best part of the night trying to get through from where we were in the middle of, where I was in the middle of the desert to the 6th Australian Division, who were up on in the Jebel. Now, communications were difficult, supplies were difficult, but it all went well.
How did you cope with things like water at that stage? You know, did you have serious problems there?
Well, you had problems. You had to carry your water with you. You had to carry your petrol, your oil, your food, your water. Yes, I think there were difficulties, but they were overcome. The water was short. Well, not as short as it had been in Gallipoli, but it was short. I think the ration in those days was a gallon a man a day.
How did you cope for things like fuel dumps? Now, was it a question of trying to place them in advance at times?
No, not at that stage. This all came later. Supply depots, the setting up of advanced supply depots was a later. But no, we hadn't got the resources, we hadn't got the supplies to do that. We had to make do with what we had. I mean, we were pretty short of stuff then. I mean, the headquarters, the Western Desert Force headquarters, we had one office lorry with flaps at the side, and that was all. We didn't have any caravans or anything like that. And from Dikkerkonda downwards, when we all slept in billies, we didn't have any tents or anything like that, and we had very limited wireless communications. I mean, we were on a narrow margin, both of supplies and equipment.
Was the morale very good? You know, as you were pressing forward.
Once you started to move forward, yeah. I mean, from the very beginning, I think, once the advance started from Mersema II against the Italian defensive position in on the frontier, and as the advance continued and the momentum was maintained, of course the morale was high. It always is. I mean, if you're going the right way and being successful, I mean, Monty always had an expression, success and everything else is added unto you, and that was the case. That was what happened in this case. But the troops were regular troops, you see, except for the Australians, who were brilliant. The Australians, meantime, fought their way through the Jebel and fetched up in Benghazi. And so we finished that campaign with 7th Armored Division in the holding the position south of Benghazi, down towards Edadabia. Well, I don't think they were in Edadabia. And the Australian division in Benghazi and the environment there. And I think it was at that time that Mr. Menzies came up, who was then Prime Minister of Australia, and saw them. And that was the first time I'd ever met him. I must say I was deeply impressed.
You met him yourself?
Yes.
He came to review the troops, did he?
He came up to see them, talked to them. They had I think, if I remember rightly, a chap called Red Robbie, who was commanding that brigade which is in Benghazi, who I got to know well later. And I think, speaking from memory again, I think there was a big sort of dinner celebration in Benghazi with Mr. Menzies there.
What was it about him that impressed you?
Well, I got to know him well later on, of course, well, but at that time I think what impressed him was he was a man of great character and courage and personality, and Oh, Jerry, he was an inspiring character. I mean, I didn't have any sort of policy discussions with him, but he inspired me as being a man of determination and character, courage.
It must have been very interesting for you, Lord Hardinge, being back in the desert again after all those years, after all you were in Palestine in World War One. Was it very different, the sort of fighting that you were now doing, you know, pushing the Italians back?
Yes, the Western Desert is very different from Sinai. Very different. I mean, the Western Desert, on the coastal side, there are sand dunes and it's very rough and difficult going. But inland, above the escarpments, it's very much better going. In fact, going from from Mersema south of Benghazi, I learned at that time that the best going was along the 400 contour. And that turned me in good stead later on in the pursuit from El Alamein. No, it's a different. There's not the same difficulty of movement. Better transport tanks, armored cars, and so on. If you stick to the right areas, you stick to where the going is good, you can get along.
Of flat, compressed sand?
Well, it's a sort of gravel. It's a sort of hard gravel with stone rushes, and it varies. It varies very much in different places. In some places, still you get poached egg country on the coast with soft sand humps, and that is difficult, very difficult going. But if you inland, you get. The texture of the surface varies. I mean, you can get it covered with small stones or big stones.
Was that a big consideration, would you think, in the Desert War, to take into account the type of land about and to use it?
Yes. I mean, if you didn't take note of going, you could get into terrible trouble.
So would you have spent quite a lot of effort in reconnaissance, you know, looking at the land?
You did quite a lot of that sort of thing, but you got to know about it from sort of personal experience, I think.
Could I ask you now about the next stage? So after Benghazi, what next?
Well, after Benghazi, we took up a defensive position at Adjadabia, which is on the south of the Gulf of Sirte starts to begin. And Dick O'Connor, at that time, and even more so later, years afterwards, felt very strongly that we ought to have gone straight on to Tripoli. Didn't agree, not because I didn't think we could do it, but I didn't think we could maintain ourselves there. After all, it would have meant a very long supply line for the Royal Navy to come from Alexandria to Tripoli to maintain us there, and also. We were really without any effective air cover. And so I held the view at that time that although I thought we could have done it, it was very doubtful whether we could have maintained our position in Tripoli, and we might have been driven back and had a bloody nose and so on. But right up to the end of his life, in fact, it worried him a great deal. And toward the end of his life, with Dick O'Connor, he felt that he ought to. We were stopped by GHQ. We were told to halt and take up a defensive position. But he felt that he ought to have taken a unilateral decision to go on. And it did worry him very, very much right up to the end of his life. but I still think that it was wrong to have done so. Well, then, of course, the next thing that happened was that two things, rather. There began to came in reports about German movement into movement of troops into Tripoli, and also what I call the Greek diversion. And we were ordered, 7th Armored Division was withdrawn to the Delta to train and re-equip. 6th Australian Division was replaced by the 9th Australian Division, who were less trained and less well-equipped. In fact, they were I think they only had two brigades with their own artillery at that time. And the whole force was very much reduced. We had very little... another so-called armored division under Gambit Parry was sent up to take the place of 7th Armored. But to my recollection was they didn't have any effective tanks. They were mostly equipped with captured Talon light tanks or some of our own Mark VI light tanks. And we had no effective anti-tank defense. I think we were left with one anti-tank battery. This was due to the diversion to Greece. Now, there's been a tremendous amount of argument about that, and I am not really competent to talk about what happened between London and Cairo. But all I do know is that when we were stuck, we were in very serious trouble at Barchi during Rommel's first offensive. Archie Wavell came up to Barchi where Philip Neame was in command, and I was chief of staff there. And we were in retreat then. So the 1st Army Division or whatever it was, well, it had been badly knocked about and were being pushed back across the desert. And 9th Australian Division were still in Benghazi. But the situation was very critical. And Archie Wavell came up, and he had a long discussion. We had a headquarters at Barchi. Had a long discussion with my boss, Philip Neame. And when he came out from it, he talked to me for a bit, and then he said, well, I suppose I could have sent less to Greece. And what that implied, I leave it to you to judge. But of course, the rights and wrongs of the decisions to go to Greece are very fully discussed by Ronald Lewin in his book The Chief. And at that time, actually, I think while we were at Barchi, Eden and Alan Brooke came up on a visit, and I remember meeting them then. And then Archie Wavell came up again, or while he was there, when he said, "I think I might have sent less to Greece." In the middle, I begged and beseeched him to get Dick O'Connor to come back, because I didn't really have any faith in Philip Neame's. He was a stranger to the desert. Jumbo Wilson had been withdrawn and sent to Greece. And so we were without a really desert experienced commander. And I thought that it would be the best thing that could happen was if Dick O'Connor could come back. He had stomach trouble, I knew that. And he had been moved back because of that to take over command of BTE, British troops in Egypt, from Dumbo Wilson when Dumbo went to Greece. But I felt very strongly that Dick, who knew the desert frightfully well and was a very desert experienced commander, ought to be brought back to take command. And so I beseeched Archie Wavell to bring him back. And He had a marvellous way, Archie Webber, of giving you a complete competence without really doing very much about it. And when he went away on that occasion, he said to me, "Well, John, I think I've done all I can to help you have done." I said, "Oh, yes, sir. Fully confident, you see." But all the same. And then what he did do was he sent Dick O'Connor back to hold Philip Neame's hand. And this was not a good arrangement. Anyway, Dick O'Connor rather resented it. He wasn't in command. He was in an advisory capacity, and it's a mistake. It was a mistake, I think. I mean, it's far be it for me to criticise Archie Wavell, but I think it was a real mistake on his part. Either Dick should have been put back in command, or something else should have been done. Anyway, that was that. And so we were really in a bit of in a frightful mess.
Was it at this time that Wavell suffered an air crash? Would that have been the occasion?
No, that was later.
Oh, was it? Sorry.
Well, that was later when I was back at Tobruk. Oh. It wasn't a crash, it was a forced landing. No, that was later. And, Gambier Paris force was completely knocked about and all completely disorganized. It wasn't completely destroyed, but it was completely disorganized and suffered very severely. And so there was no, and there was a lorried infantry brigade back at, not Zeus, where was it? I can't remember now. Not Mekele, I suppose. Yes, back at Mekele. And the 6th and 9th Australian Division withdrawing through the Jebel under pressure from Rommel. So it was a pretty hairy situation, all told.
What was your first impression of Rommel when he started moving forward? Would he have been practicing what we call the Blitzkrieg? Would that have been possible?
I don't think I knew enough about him at that time. I ought to have known more about him. We got intelligence reports that they had landed at Tripoli, that they had... I don't remember whether we had detail of the order of battle then, but they certainly were forming building up Africa Corps, what was later Africa Corps there. And our impression was, or our calculation was, that they wouldn't be in a position to start an offensive for some time. And Ronald Lewin quotes me having sent out a signal to the effect that they could not be expected to start their offensive for some time. Actually, I was wrong. And we had underestimated Rommel's drive, energy, and so on. Maybe we ought to have known, I don't remember knowing much about him. From the experience of him on the Western Front, we ought to have known much more about him and been able to assess his both his intentions and his capabilities at an earlier stage.
So when you heard that this man Rommel had arrived, it really didn't mean much to you in terms of character and reputation. Is that right?
Well, yes, I think it's more or less right. Yes, now I personally didn't credit him with the qualities that I ought to have known that he had if I'd had full information about his performance on the Western Front in the German offensive, original German offensive.